You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Proud to be joined right now by a former commanding officer of mine and currently a senior fellow and co-director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at Brookings, and that is General John R. Allen. Sir, first of all, thanks for coming on All Marine Radio.
Mac, it's a pleasure to be with you. As you pointed out very early in your introduction, and I would certainly have pointed it out, it was a great pleasure for me and a real honor for me to serve with you in the Corps, at least one of the most important moments that we had in terms of progress in education in the Marine Corps. So thank you for your contributions as well, brother.
You know, sir, I will tell you, it's been great fun, you know, watching your career and all the different things that you've done, and certainly been an exciting few years since we crossed paths in 1991.
It certainly has been. Great times.
I want to talk about, as uncomfortable you as you will be with this subject, we'll talk about it anyway because it's my radio show. why did you join the Marine Corps?
It was a story my father told me when I was very young. He'd been the UPSO on an aircraft carrier in the Korean War, and a Marine fighter squadron was flying off his carrier. He was on the USS Bataan, one of the World War II Jeep carriers, and the checkerboard squadron was flying off of that carrier, and it was flying around the clock, supporting the retrograde of the 1st Division from the Chosin Reservoir. And his stories of the Marine pilots and their commitment to getting down low and attacking the Chinese to keep them off the backs of the Marines so they could make that difficult passage through the mountains. And in particular, a story about one Marine that was shot down, and the rest of the flight kept stationed on top of him, keeping the Chinese from getting at this pilot, so the rescue helicopter, the Sarberg, could get in to get him. And eventually the squadron skipper sent everybody home because they'd all run out of ammunition and they were running out of gas. He stayed over top to the very end and trying to protect one of his young pilots on the ground, he was shot down and killed. And my father told me about the grief and the sense of loss by every Marine in that squadron at the loss of their squadron skipper. And that stuck with me from the time I was a very young child. I wanted to be part of an organization where the individuals of that organization could feel that way about each other. And that started it. And my dad, I think, as a Navy officer, would have wanted me to join the Navy, but he was very proud that I would go in the Corps. And his early stories about the camaraderie of the Marine Corps was what sparked my interest.
And your dad was a black shoe officer in the Navy?
He was. He started out enlisted, up through the ranks, was promoted to chief. But for his heroism in combat aboard the destroyer USS Woolsey, supporting the Army beachhead at Anzio Beach, he was commissioned and was sent to the Pacific and spent the rest of the year there, rest of the war there, and was anchored in Tokyo Bay when the surrender occurred in Tokyo Bay. He was also, by the way, as a young enlisted sailor, on board the USS Kearney, brand new destroyer, convoying a British convoy in October of 1941. So the war hadn't started for us when his ship was torpedoed by a German U-boat. And, of course, they survived. And his experience in World War II started before the war in combat against the German U-boat fleet. He would remain on a new destroyer convoying. He fought all the way across the Mediterranean, was commissioned and sent to the Pacific and fought across the Pacific and was there when the surrender was signed on the deck of the Missouri.
You know, sir, I have to tell you that one of the most motivating things I've ever seen is to see somebody meritoriously promoted in combat. I remember a corporal promoted to sergeant on the spot in Ramadi in 2004 and standing at the formation. And, you know, to think that I've earned this combat because of the way I fight and the way I lead in combat, I don't think there's a greater compliment you could give anybody who serves, in this case, a corporal in the Marine Corps, but your dad certainly the same way. That what an awesome way to be commissioned.
It really was. The story of the fight, which resulted in his being commissioned, is actually part of history. A Tiger tank unit had broken through on the flank of the beachhead and was coming down the beach trying to get into the rear of the Army elements. And their destroyer saw, this is Woolsey, the USS Woolsey, skipper on the Woolsey saw all this unfolding and brought the Woolsey in as close to the beach line as they could, beachhead as they could, and began a direct fire engagement with the main battery of the USS Woolsey against a Tiger tank unit. Imagine that. So in the middle of that fight, the gun director goes down. You know, the gun director is the mechanism that points the guns.
Roger.
And it broke. And so with all the machine gun fire from the tanks and the main gun battery, the main guns going off, my father climbed the masthead under fire, repaired the gun director so that Woolsey could remain in the fight. And eventually it went down again. He went up a second time. So, you know, heroism in combat comes in lots of different shapes and forms and fashions, but in this case, to be hanging off a masthead as main gun rounds, 88 rounds are going by it. Pretty proud of it.
Wow. That's an incredible, the start of the Northern Atlantic during Lend-Lease convoys, then, off the coast of Italy, and then he winds up in Tokyo Bay.
That's right.
Wow. What a career, what a naval career. Let's
talk, he was a good man. Yep.
Let's talk about what are the things that shaped you? Obviously, your tours, culminating in your command of ISAF forces, but also, your command in Al Anbar. You obviously rose to the rarefied air of commanding combat for the nation. What shaped you as a leader? You talked about your dad and why you joined, but you joined the Marine Corps. Are there any tours or people that really shaped you as a young officer?
There were, Mac, and you were a big part of one of them. But first of all, I learned a lot about being an officer from my dad. And I remember when he and I were spending a lot of time together as I was in my formative years. He had great admiration for the skipper of the Kearney, who was a young lieutenant commander, Naval Academy grad. And in those days, 1939, 40, and early 41, virtually all the officers in the Navy were Naval Academy grads. And he talked about who they were and his respect for them. And when the Kearney was torpedoed, his name was Danis, Lieutenant Commander Danis, was badly wounded by the explosion of the torpedo. And he refused to leave the bridge, even though he was bleeding from both ears and probably had a major, what we would call a traumatic brain injury today, and would eventually receive the Navy Cross. But my father admired those qualities of humble servitude. In other words, officers who felt first and foremost that their mission was to win in combat, but to serve their units and to do it with a sense of humility. And I learned that from him. It was reinforced to me by an instructor I had in high school, a fellow by the name of Colonel Alan Ferguson Warren. I went to a school in Fairfax called Flint Hill. And he was a Royal Marine commando who had been captured by the Japanese, and the character of Alec Guinness in the movie Bridge on the River Kwai was a composite character, of which part of that composite was Colonel Alan Ferguson Warren, who spent several years in that Japanese POW camp on the Kwai, building the Borough Railroad system. So I learned a lot about the qualities of a leader from him. And so I felt as though when I got to the Naval Academy and I would become a young officer in the Marine Corps, that I had certainly seen some examples and heard a lot about what it took to be a successful officer. One of the great examples for me and still remains someone I point to constantly was my tour at the Marine Barracks, Washington, D.C. at 8th and I, and the skipper, the commander there, then Colonel, who would eventually retire as Major General, Orlo K. Steele, O.K. Steele.
Roger.
Who, you know, had this really impeccable and unimpeachable combat record, but was in every sense of the word one of the greatest gentlemen I ever met, a great historian. He was a scholar of the profession of arms, set the perfect example for us, and sought as an individual to try to bring the best out of all of the young officers serving with. And to this day, I think one of the greatest teachers that I ever had was Orlo K. Steele, O.K. Steele, and the environment that he created amongst the officers of the mess in the Marine Barracks in Washington. And that example of his scholarship and his humility, his sense of operational excellence, that stuck with me and really shaped me for a long time. You know, later I'd had the chance to serve with other great officers, too many to acknowledge today. We don't have the time, Matt, but certainly what shaped me in a very big way was when you and I were serving together and we dedicated ourselves to understanding the human factors in combat and what it takes to make a decision in war, sort of the neuro-mental processes that are necessary to do all that. You know, we did that at a scientific level. And I have to tell you, when I would later lead troops and serve in Iraq and then lead a whole theater of war in Afghanistan, I was well served by the days as a major where we read in a very, very focused way about why commanders were able to command and what shaped their lives as they were evolving through the ranks as a young officer to the point where they become generals. And it was a really important moment for me, and it shaped everything that followed, frankly. The time you and I served together at the infantry officer course, and then when I would go back and command the basic school. Those moments, those opportunities in a school environment to truly study your profession are rare opportunities, and I think I was able to take advantage of it, and you were a big part of that for me.
You know, sir, you have to come back again because there's, as you're talking, I'm remembering conversations of us at Gettysburg talking about the morning of the second day when Lee's engineer goes and does a reconnaissance of Little Round Top, and he comes back and he gives Lee the wrong information, tells him he's wrong. Lee engineers Longstreet's march, and I want to talk about that, but you're sitting there, you know it's going to unfold, but you're looking at it, at the report going, that's wrong. And how does the commander react when the whole plan is based on wrong information and he doesn't even know it yet, but he's going to find out? All those things that we had great discussions about. So you got to come back and we have to talk about education and how to do that better. But I want to continue on leadership. Does leadership change in a coalition environment? You know, the challenges of leadership in Afghanistan, in Iraq, for officers, non-commissioned officers, for female officers, when they walk in the room and everybody goes stiff. Does leadership change in a coalition environment? Because it's certainly more complex.
You know, I don't know. That's a great question, Mac. I don't know that the leadership changes. I think you have to exercise more tools, perhaps. But I don't think that the principles of leadership change. And I'll tell you why. Because I've served, I think, in 5 coalitions. The first one I served in was the coalition that came together for the tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
And then the coalition in Bosnia, the coalition at CENTCOM. The one in Afghanistan, the 50-nation coalition of ISAF, and then the president asked me to build him a coalition for fighting ISIL. And what I have discovered is that all of the things that make, in this case, a Marine, that makes a Marine a great leader are valued incredibly by our coalition partners. I mean, when they see the strong, positive, assertive leadership of an American commander who takes into account the opinions and the nature of the various states of the coalition into his decision making, you just can't imagine how they're affected by that and how much more the commitment is that they'll display to the mission of the coalition. So I don't know that leadership changes, but I think you need to exercise some more tools. And one of the tools is that, and I had a long conversation with my leadership. In fact, within an hour of my taking command in Afghanistan, I convened all of my leadership, my British three-star deputy commander, my French three-star chief of staff, all of my division commanders, my Army three-star corps commander, my three-star detainee, operations commander, my NATO training mission commander, all of them. I got them in the room and I gave them my commander's intent. You and I talked about this. And it was that was a habit I had from the time I was a captain. Within moments of taking command, you got to put your stamp on the organization. And I told them when I took command of the organization, I would lead them from the front. I expected my general officers to share the danger in the battle space with their troops. I also told them that for me, the center of gravity of the campaign was the coherence and the integrity of the coalition. And so while I would direct the campaign to defeat the Taliban, I would also take personal responsibility for the management of the coalition in order to ensure that we as 50 nations remained singularly focused in accomplishing the objectives of the strategy. And that's really important because as a coalition commander, you cannot afford to have the coalition begin to fray or begin to come apart, because the cascade effect and the acceleration of the sense of loss can really happen quickly, and you have to keep your eyes on it. I'll stop there for your thoughts.
No, I know. I know it's harder, and you watch the dance that is done from squad leaders, sergeants running firm bases along with lieutenants in this decentralized fight in Afghanistan, dealing with, you know, with village elders, right? Dealing with chiefs of police, the complexities of the opium trade layered over where, at least where I was down in Helmand, and then, you know, the ISAF forces, you know, who may or may not be, you know, have any indigenous roots in the area, and all the complexities. And if you watch young leaders operate in that environment, it's certainly not easy. And it's not easy to sustain giving our deployments and our rotation. So I just wondered, do you have any advice for junior leaders that will certainly go into maybe not the same set of circumstances, but other not dissimilar circumstances? Any advice for junior leaders when you're headed in that direction?
Sure.
What to consider?
Well, you know, the first thing I would say is that there will be few occasions in the future, and there have actually been very few occasions in the past, where the United States is not going to operate in a combat environment or in a broad conflict other than in a coalition. And so when you anticipate operating in a coalition, the chances are pretty good you're going to know who it is you're going to serve with, whether the countries will be either serving with you in your unit or serving with you in the same battle space. And I would make the effort for a young officer to learn as much as I possibly could about the history of those forces, about the nature of the social environment in which those forces are produced. So, for example, when I would go to Herat, to Regional Command West in Afghanistan, which was led by the Italians, I would take the time to learn about the specific units that were there. And when you knew about those units and you could get on the ground and meet a commander, and this is for a captain or a battalion commander, a lieutenant colonel, or a four-star general, when you can look that counterpart or look that subordinate allied commander in the face, speak a little bit of his language, talk a bit about the traditions and the heritage of his particular unit, you can't imagine how it increases the cohesion of the coalition, how it blends together their sense of loyalty for you and their willingness to execute the missions of an officer that's not of their nation and not of their nationality. And I had great Army and Marine, Army Division commanders and Marine MEF commanders, and with all of the loyalty that came with our being both countrymen and of the same cloth, I would also tell you that my Italian leadership, my British leadership in the South, my German leadership in the North, because I spent a lot of time on coalition management and getting to know them personally, the sense of loyalty and camaraderie that we shared was, I can't overstate how important it is. So for a young officer, if you're going to serve with another country's units, you need to learn everything you possibly can about that country, about the traditions and the history of its military, about the specific heraldry of that unit. And when you get to know them at that level, then you'll find that a camaraderie will grow and a cohesion will emerge that you almost just can't pay for. And as we all know, cohesive units in combat will hold together in ways that far exceed the sum of the parts. It's almost a spiritual relationship under the hammer blows of combat. So, it's not going to be the other way. You're not going to find the other nations reaching out to us in that manner, because they just won't be cued to think in those terms. But when an American officer shows up and can speak a little of the language, and knows that unit's heritage and can talk about its coat of arms, boy, you just can't imagine how that increases the cohesion of the coalition.
Retired Marine General John Allen, our guest this morning on All Marine Radio, the former commander of ISAF forces and the president's special presidential envoy for the Global Coalition Against ISIL. Sir, are you okay on time?
Yeah.
All right. We're going to continue then. So I want to ask you about the current fight in Afghanistan. One of the things the year that I spent there, I looked at what we were trying to create and I thought, if Germany and Japan were 30 to 40 year events in terms of the reconstruction, the stabilization of those two nations post World War II as part of the Marshall Plan, at least in Europe, we're trying to create something in Afghanistan that's never, in my opinion, in my reading, that's never been, and that is a nation. Is the watch too short for this? Is our horizon, because we go to war to win the peace, and if we don't win the peace, then it was all for naught. So can you talk to me and talk to us about where we are relative to winning the peace? Is it going to be a longer term event than we would like it to be? But simply, that's the nature of the beast when we're trying to engineer such a fundamental change in that part of the world.
It's going to take longer, Mac, than the timelines that this White House has put on it, frankly. And I've been public on this issue. I think that the numbers that we have dedicated to the process are too few, and the timeline for our withdrawal is too short. And I've called on the administration, and I've called on others to reexamine both of those. And this is not the last you'll hear of me on this subject. We went from a Japan that was flat on its back at the end of World War II to today having the third strongest economy on the planet. We went from a Korea that was flat on its back at the end of the Korean War to having the ninth or tenth most effective economy on the planet, a very effective democracy, as is Japan's democracy. The same with Germany. Germany is an economic and political powerhouse. And none of those things occurred because we did, in the aftermath of war, 5 years of a limited presence and then pulled out. I almost can't imagine where we would be today if that had been the driving operational thinking at the time. I commanded roughly 150,000 troops, spending between $8 and $9 billion a month. And for us to go from that size force to something less than 10,000 and do it for only 5 years and expect that with an active insurgency that has no intention of coming to the table, and Pakistan, which appears to have no intention of being helpful in the peace process, nor to reduce its safe havens, which have given sanctuary to the Taliban now for years, with virtually none of those things really changed, except that we certainly push the Taliban back as we were building the Afghan security forces out. Our departure, just as it did in Iraq, is going to create a risk, a level of risk. And we have to recognize that. So my concerns are that our numbers are too few and our drawdown timeline is too quick. But there's no bad time to make the right decision. And my hope would be that we can get this under control relatively soon. And the new administration, I don't want to get into the politics, but the new administration will take the time to do a comprehensive assessment of the relationship, the inextricable relationship of the political health of the nation with its economic progress, with the security situation, because they're all inextricably linked. They're all tied together, to take the time to do the kind of assessment necessary to determine, in the aftermath of several years of post-conflict international support, whether we're on track or not. Because if we just maintain this drawdown schedule and numbers, I think we're creating for ourselves the same kind of challenge that we now have to address a second time in Iraq.
You know, so that's when the president announced his timeline, it was while I was deployed to the Helmand province, and we immediately began receiving reports of communications between local leaders and the Taliban in Pakistan saying that, hey, look, just want you guys to know that we have to deal with the Americans because they run the show now, just like we had to deal with the Russians. But you know that when you come back, you know who side we're really on. And so, you know, that planned withdrawal, I mean, it was so frustrating because you could already see them. They were biding their time because they weren't sure if we were going to stay. Just like in Al Anbar when, you know, you'd go into a village that we didn't occupy all the time, and the villagers wanted to help you. And the first question they would ask is, how long are you going to stay? Because the people that used to live in that house, they helped you last time, and you left, and they're dead. So I want to help you because I know you guys are trying to do better, but unless you'll stay and be strong, I can't help you. So do you have an answer for that?
Well, no, I don't have an answer because you didn't really ask me a question. What you did was to make a statement that is absolutely correct, and it is at the heart of the problem that we're facing now, and that is we have, for all intents and purposes, have been successful in the conflict. But these conflicts don't end when the guns fall silent, so to speak. These conflicts end many years or even sometimes decades later. And it requires a constant touch of some form or another. But you can't just say, and you just can't isolate the security dimension of what you're doing from the economic dimension of what you're doing and from the governance as well. You simply can't isolate them. They're all inextricably linked. So when you pull down our security presence, it also then forces the embassy to pull back its capability of touching key Afghan leaders who, now feeling exposed because there's the security presence and the security calculus has changed, and feeling neglected because there's no American political touch, it creates a sense, as you pointed out correctly, that there will be a willingness to accommodate the enemy. And when that occurs, since the enemy has never been about economic progress or any kind of economic situation that we would recognize, then the economy begins to flag and money starts to flee. So they're all inextricably linked. And my position would be, please stop the drawdown right now. That doesn't mean we haven't been successful. That doesn't mean we failed. That doesn't mean that the intent to draw down was bad. But let's stop for now, because the Taliban are not willing to make peace. We just killed Mullah Mansour, who needed killing, because we thought he might be a partner for peace. It turned out to be even worse. So he needed to go away. We now have the emergence of something called the Wilayat Khorasan, which is a province of the ISIL caliphate, which has emerged in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it is a further complication to the security situation. It's time for us to stop the drawdown and take a moment and a deep breath, because the next president is going to end up owning the outcome in Afghanistan. let's let her or him take the time, having stopped the drawdown, having frozen everything in place, let's let her or him do a detailed assessment of the state of the governance, the state of the economy, in the context of the state of the security, because they're all inextricably linked. And if we don't take a big step backwards and a strong, thorough investigation of this, we're liable to find ourselves once again re-employing troops back into Afghanistan, and now, just as we are in Iraq, in an emergency situation.
General John Allen, our guest. One more question about Afghanistan, and then I want to talk about ISIL. How do we supplant opium in Afghanistan as a cornerstone of that economy?
Well, that's a really hard question, Mac. You know, it's, once again, it's a matter of both will and capability, you know, how you address these issues. I came along in the process probably, I'll just put it this way. You know, I commanded for, you know, almost 19 months in Afghanistan from 11 to 13. And it became clear to me in the latter part of my command that I really wasn't facing the Taliban as a threat. I was facing a triangular threat. If you imagine the legs of a triangle, and the one leg of the triangle is what I call the ideological insurgency. That was the Taliban. And in some places in Afghanistan, we decisively defeated them.
Mm-hmm.
A second leg of the threat was the organized and sometimes highly sophisticated criminal networks, which had been, in many respects, the surviving aspects of the Afghan tribal society during the really terrible times after the communist coup, and then during the Soviet occupation, and then during the civil war, and then later during the Taliban. These criminal networks were quite effective, quite insidious. They captured many of the functions of government, and it was a real problem. And then the third leg of the triangle, depending on where you were, these were equilateral triangles or isosceles triangles with the legs being different lengths. But the third leg was the leg of the drug enterprise, which fueled the other two. And all three of those entities were in a symbiotic relationship. And we never embraced that as the threat entity in our engagement in Afghanistan. For example, I had no capacity to go after the drug enterprise, except insofar as I was able to determine that any particular aspect of the enterprise was directly fueling the Taliban. Now, that also, what that meant was, if I just came across a drug lab somewhere, or, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of hectares of cultivated poppy fields, I couldn't take unilateral action to reduce any of that. I could support the Afghan counter-drug units, but they weren't particularly committed either. So, first and foremost, we have to recognize what our problem is. And our problem is a symbiotic relation between those three dimensions of the threat. And when the time comes, you have to deal with those in a comprehensive way. So I'll stop there.
All right, we'll transition. I just, you know, we watched the poppy eradication program, and if you had enough money, you know, to pay the chief of police, then your crop didn't get eradicated. You know, they may have driven over it, you know, once with a broken down tractor, and then so they could say they tried or they attempted eradication or whatnot. We were forbidden to get involved in it, and so we watched it. But really, what you saw driving it was the economics of what other crop are they going to plant that is going to pay, because farmers can add and subtract, is going to pay them what opium pays them. And the answer is nothing else is close, and there isn't. I mean, in that godforsaken part of the country, there isn't a whole lot there anyway. And so it's for a farmer and a civilization that is now, you know, essentially keeled out of the poppy, you know, because that's what provides all the money to make everything work. It's like, so what supplants that? And I never saw a good answer, sir. And your answer is the right one. You got to deal with those three legs of the triangle, because if you only deal with one or two, it's not going to work.
No, that's right. And the crop substitution program was an honest effort by a lot of people to try to do the right thing. But let's think about, just as you pointed out, let's think about the timelines associated with trying to bring to bear for the purposes of profit an alternative crop like the pomegranate, which is characteristic of and part of the Afghan culture. No, that's decades in the future. We want farmers to supplant the amount of money they can make by cultivating poppies for pomegranates when the true payoff is years and years in the future, and they don't know whether we're going to be here. And, you know, so it's unless we're willing to treat in a symbiotic way all three legs of the triangle, because they are operating in a symbiotic way, then it won't be holistic, and we'll find ourselves wondering what's going on in some parts of the battle space.
General John Allen, our guest, former ISAF commander, former special presidential envoy for the Global Coalition Against ISIL, and general of Marines for a very, very long time. We're going to take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, we're back. General Allen continues with us. Sir, I want to switch gears. Talk to us about ISIL. And you know, I look at that. Syria and Russia, Turkey and the Kurds, the anti-Assad forces, and then our coalition. We had three legs in Afghanistan. How many legs are there in Syria? And how do you get your hands around that problem?
Well, you've asked me several different questions here, and the answer to any one of those is a full day long, full day long radio symposium that you and I ought to try to do someday. But you asked me about ISIL first. Let me take a huge step back and tell you that unless we, as a community of nations in the West, are willing to approach the issue of the radicalization of hundreds of thousands of young Muslims around the world. And this is not about being a Muslim. It's about conditions that lead to mass hopelessness and the radicalization in the sense of fury that their parent governments have no capacity to care for them, no intention to care for them, and no potential to care for them. Unless we as a community of nations are willing to undertake an endeavor as big as the Marshall Plan, a generational approach, we are going to be facing an issue of mass radicalization and extremist organizations, violent extremist organizations like ISIL, for generations. And we have to grip this, because the solution, Mac, cannot be frozen conflict. The solution cannot be permanent war. And your sons are already young officers in the Marine Corps. I've got a grandson who likely will serve in the Corps. And I don't want to see your sons fight extremist organizations, because we haven't done anything to resolve the underlying circumstances. And I don't want to see my grandson and probably his grandson fight. But that's where we're headed. If we don't get a grip on these underlying social, economic, and political issues that radicalize hundreds of thousands of young men and women who desperately just want prospects, that's the first issue. That's what's causing so many of these problems in the Middle East and the broader North African, Middle East, South Asian regions. And it's really the cause for the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring. It wasn't about faith. To some extent, there was that component within it. But it primarily was about large segments of the population, what's often called the youth bulge, of kids who had no hope. They turned on their governments, and one after another, they went down. Tunisia went down. Libya went down. Egypt went down twice. Yemen's gone down. Iraq's nearly gone down. Many of the other states in the Gulf were violently assailed by civil unrest. And, of course, the great poster child of how bad this can be, a region with failed governments and engaged in civil war, is Syria. Syria is the ultimate example of how bad this can be. And unless we try to get, as I said, to the underlying circumstances, we're going to find more of these examples. And it's going to be a real problem for us. So with that as context, these violent extremist organizations, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Abu Sayyaf, Jamaat Islamiya, all of these organizations typically have many of the same characteristics. And in the case of ISIL, it was, in fact, a component of Al-Qaeda, and we fought them. We fought them in Iraq. In fact, we killed the leader of that organization, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is a mad dog in my mind, and we didn't get his deputy, and his deputy today is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, also known as Caliph Ibrahim, the leader of the so-called caliphate. And so the organization, Mac, is a symptom of something bigger, something darker, something that has yet to be resolved by the people in the region because of their limited capacity and is yet to be fully embraced by the community of nations as, in many respects, the kind of existential threat that the Soviets were to the West many years ago. So ISIL is a symptom of something worse. We're engaged now in dealing with it. But in dealing with ISIL, it can't be the end state of our effort. It has to be a waypoint in the larger, probably generationally oriented effort that we have to undertake.
Right, let me ask you about that. So the ISIL issue now, to me, seems to be just another preliminary as Iran and Saudi Arabia do this dance. And until they can, as nations, as peoples, until they can accept the joint responsibility to work together, to accept each other's presence, nothing productive happens. And we can fake it. We can fence them off. You know, we can go there and we can keep the lid on it. But until Saudi Arabia and Iran somehow or other accept each other's presence, I don't. How does this work, sir?
Well, it hasn't obviously for a very long time, and you know it's a really perceptive question on your part. When I talk to people who are trying to understand the region, one of the first things I tell them is, in your analysis, as you seek to understand the region, as you seek to react to events that are unfolding before you, if one of the first considerations that you have isn't what I call the Cold War between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the revolutionary Islamic regime in Tehran, if that isn't one of your earliest considerations as to why something is happening in the region, you're probably going to miss the reality in your analysis. So that's the first thing. Now, why is there competition? It's only partly religion and maybe isn't mostly religion. Or the confession that one worships Shia for the Iranians and Sunni for the Saudis. I would contend that it's really much bigger than that. It is competition politically. It's hegemonic competition to dominate as much of the influence in the region as possible. It's economic competition in the context of the oil enterprise. And then in there somewhere is the inherent friction that comes from a violent Shia revolutionary regime bumping up against a fundamentalist Sunni Wahhabi-oriented system of faith in the kingdom. And all of that makes for what would appear to be frozen conflict. So, you know, the recent comments came out of Washington of something to the effect of, why don't you guys just figure out how to arrange the neighborhood and share the neighborhood? That couldn't have gone down more difficultly in the region, because those guys aren't interested in sharing anything, and they're not gonna. And the Iranian effort to have a nuclear weapon has spurred the Saudis, and King Abdullah, before he passed away, Saudi Arabia said to me twice that Saudi Arabia will never end up number two in a nuclear arms race. These are big stakes here in the region. And unless the United States is part of the process to keep the lid on it, this could go badly. And the complete collapse of Yemen is probably one of the examples of what happens when we aren't involved in the process and the Saudis undertake a military coalition to defeat the Houthis, who they believe and probably are supported by the Iranians. And it's very much a Cold War environment at several different levels, and it makes stability in the region, in the Gulf, but more broadly in the region. It makes finding stability and ensuring stability pretty difficult.
With that as a backdrop, what is the way ahead for the United States and the coalition that you essentially crafted? What is the way ahead for the United States and its coalition in the fight against ISIL?
Well, we're gaining traction now. You know, as I said to leaders in Washington, you can't take on an organization that looks like a juggernaut. You can't take it on frontally, as we did, in a moment of really grave emergency in the late summer of 14, and expect to have immediate results. And so what we did was we chose to take this organization on in roughly five different ways. The first was the military way, which is the most obvious. Gets a lot of the attention, but it isn't in the end where the decision will be determined. So we have the military activity going on, and there's a lot of purchase occurring. We've taken back a lot of the ground, liberated a lot of the population. Cities that you knew and I knew have either been liberated or being liberated. We're fighting in Fallujah, even as you and I speak right now.
Roger.
Another area is the area of the finances. The finances provide the capacity for the organization to operate. And we've really begun to shrink the finances by attacking the oil enterprise, shrinking the capacity of the banking system to provide the platform for economic solvency. We've gone after their leaders. We're attacking their cash repositories. They had quite a large amount of cash that they took out of the banks. Gone after those. We're shrinking their financial assets. We've begun the process in a comprehensive way of reducing the flow of foreign fighters. They have been reduced substantially from the beginning. We're attacking their narrative, going after them in an information conflict, and then we're stabilizing the population. But all of that doesn't happen overnight. It took us a year to get organized, a year to assemble the resources, and in the second year of the campaign, the tide has turned against the enemy. But as I've told everyone all along, we can't find ourselves at the end of the 3 or 4 years it's going to take us to defeat Daesh, lift our heads up and say, oh, good, now we're finished. Because we're not finished, because they're just as Daesh is a lineal descendant of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and Al-Qaeda is a lineal descendant of other extremist organizations, if we don't get after, as I said previously, if we don't get after the underlying reasons why the people of that region are radicalized and forced into the arms of these violent extremists, if we don't get after that, we are going to fight son of Daesh and grandson of Daesh, and it's going to go for a long time.
John Allen, our guest, he and I have known each other for almost 25 years now, and certainly a privilege to have you on the program today, sir. And obviously, All Marine Radio just starting out. Want to thank you. I want to switch gears now because you're right. We could spend a week on each one of those topics. I want to talk to you about post-combat mental health. And it's something that, you know, affects us all deeply. You know, you go through what you go through in Iraq and Afghanistan. You see the courage and selflessness that, you know, that brings tears to your eyes. And you don't see it occasionally. You see it every day. 19, 20-year-old lance corporals, sergeants, you know, getting after it every day. The courage they show, the way they protect civilians, the way they restrain their own destructive capability. It's just so impressive. And then come home, struggle, and then, you know, some take their lives, some struggle with depression and anger management, and their lives are never the same. Give us your basic thoughts, and then I have some specific questions about post-combat related mental health for Marines, current and former, that are listening today.
Mac, it's a really important subject. It's hard to overstate how important it is. It's difficult to find the words for it. You may remember when you and I served together at the Infantry Officer Course, I introduced into the program something called the Chaos Exercise, where I wanted people to be confronted with this complete sense of chaos, a sense that you know, all of their senses were assailed at the same time. Their capacity to see order in what was happening around them had been completely compromised. And in the aftermath of that, we talked about what we called were the unseen wounds. And this was 90 to 92. And this, my concern was that at the time, we were not postured really to, as a nation and as an armed force, to understand that, we will have people who will be physically wounded or physically injured in combat. But we weren't really postured in a comprehensive and an aggressive way to deal with the unseen wounds that come from the emotional and psychological dislocation by being exposed to and immersed in the most horrendous, catastrophic moment in human existence, which is close combat in war. There's almost nothing that comes close to the experience, and no one can emerge from that experience unchanged. And we all react differently to the experience of combat. Some come back and they're changed, but they're changed in ways that are certainly manageable and are even sometimes imperceptible to the person themselves. You know, sleep disorders a little bit or just sleep disruption, and it's an annoyance, but people deal with it. Or you have the other end of the spectrum, which is real psychological dislocation, and it has ways of manifesting itself all the way to the point where people have lost all hope and tragically take their lives. And I think we now understand that in ways we could not have imagined in the 10th of September 2001. We've always been committed to helping our troops through their psychological challenges as they come out of combat, but we certainly embraced in the last 15 years or so understanding it better and trying to help more. So it's hard for me to say that we've got a full handle on it yet, but I would also say with folks like General Corelli in the Army, who's done such great work on post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, and the work of Commandant Jim Amos in the Marine Corps, and so many others of our senior leaders and medical officers, we're working very hard to create programs that can help these youngsters, these young men and women, through the psychological and the emotional wounding that comes from the experience that generates physical wounds in others. And we have an obligation to do that for them. We have an obligation as a society to help them. And some of it will be done by the services. Some of it will be done by the Veterans Administration. Some of it will be done by nonprofit organizations that have really embraced this in an important way. And I'll just stop there, Mac, because it's hard to even put into words how much we owe these kids and how terribly so many of them suffer to the point where, as we know, the daily suicide rate in this country is really tragic.
You know, so it's so frustrating when you hear that somebody's taken their own life, and, you know, to live through what, you know, these young men and women have lived through. And like I said, if you could see them every day, it would make you cry. If you see what they do every day, how they put out for their country, it's absolutely incredible. And then to see them come home, and I think really frustrating for me is when you read the stories, and there was a couple articles in the New York Times in September about 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, and when they go and they're doing what we tell them to in TAP class, you know, go to the VA. And then they get frustrated by, look, they want to medicate me, but they don't want to, nobody wants to talk to me and to deal with my issues, you know. And I remember, I think the kid was a machine gunner, and he said he was really good at spotting IDs and was the second vehicle in a movement in Afghanistan. And, you know, the first vehicle hits one, and now he feels guilty because he didn't see the ID in front of the first vehicle. And his squad leader was killed, who he loved. You know, I want to draw the parallel to Mike Strank. On Iwo Jima, you know, the devastation that a squad feels, and that you personally didn't feel that. and then the isolation, and they're going to try to get therapy, and that it's not working for them. And, you know, part of the reason for All Marine Radio is to give those guys a connection back to us, because we're their tribe. And I tell Marines, hey, put your dog tags back on. It's just a daily reminder. Those things get caught in your armpit when you roll over in bed. You hear the jingle, but we're your tribe. You're not getting away from us. You're not getting away from the experience. And so just don't forever forget that you're not alone. You're not alone. We're here, and we want you, when you're struggling, just to cover down on us. And we'll get you to a better place, just like we've done in combat, just like we did in training. Just cover down. Don't think it too much. And just come back to us and hang with us and be with us. And I just your thoughts on that message, sir, because you know what a tight organization the Marine Corps is, and that you know, especially among those of us who, you know, we love ourselves like nobody else. Your thoughts on that message, come back to us and don't ever give up hope and don't ever get too far away from us.
Well, I think the Corps is really well postured to do that, Mac, and I think it's, you know, nobody should ever be satisfied with the status quo. No one should ever be satisfied that we have done all that we can do. But I think the Corps has done a lot. And my message to someone who has trouble is to reach out as much as they possibly can. Because there are people out there who will take that phone call. There are people out there, and I, in terms of this interview, I didn't come equipped to talk about all this, so I didn't have phone numbers in my head and that sort of thing. But there are people 24 hours a day ready to take that phone call when a young Marine Lance Corporal who has done his country's bidding, who may have been physically wounded, but certainly has been mentally wounded, believes he can't stand being on this earth another second. The pain is too great. And it becomes a physical pain at some point, not just an emotional pain or a psychological pain. And the pure, dark agony that some of these kids face is something that we should be very attentive to. We should be ready at a moment's notice to sprint from the flank to support them in their battle with this unseen wound to try to get them through. And I think it's probably worth a program, Mac. I'm not going to suggest you do that necessarily, but there are people out there, especially with All Marine Radio and getting a lot of our veterans to listen to this, bringing some people on who are able to say, if you've got a problem, call this number and we will come running from the flank to help you. They're out there to do that. And I believe we have an obligation to do that for them. You know, Marines are a very special organization. And we're special not in the physical sense, we're special in the spiritual sense. And it's a spiritual obligation that we have to each other. Having shared this environment of combat, the intensity of war, and the sense of commitment we have to our country, and it's a spiritual obligation as well.
The number you were looking for, sir, is 800-273-8255, and that's the VA's Veteran Crisis Line. And so if you are listening and you're either a family member or you're a veteran, a former Marine, or an active duty Marine, and you're struggling, call that number. They're standing by. They'll wait. They'll talk to you. And again, that number is 800-273-8255. All right, so I want to, you bet, sir. And I will bring you back. And you know, again, you know how special these men and women are who've given so much and who are now struggling with this stuff, and we'll talk about it again, but I appreciate your thoughts. Couple of quick questions for you and then we'll let you go. And I certainly appreciate your time today, sir.
Sure.
First of all, give me a good book to read that I haven't read yet.
Mac, I'm not sure there are any books that have ever been written in the West you haven't read.
There are. Hey, sir, after you taught me how to sample a book, I got much better at it.
Yeah. I'll come back to you. There's a whole series of books that have been written not too distant past. Will McCants has written probably one of the best books on ISIS. If you've not read it, you ought to read it. It is so good that not long ago we had a SIGINT cut. In other words, we heard two ISIS guys talking, and one of them said, well, you know, what is it that we stand for? The guy said, read Will McCants' book. So I would say for the the folks who are interested in understanding what this organization is that we are ultimately going to drive a stake through the heart of, Will McCants' book on ISIS would be a very good one. And he spells it M-C-C-A-N-T-S. William McCants, a great scholar.
M-C-C-A-N-T-S. All right. Give me one of your favorite historical people and why.
The Field Marshal, the Viscount Sir William Slim. That's a non-American. He wrote the finest memoir of World War II, Defeat into Victory, and it taught me more about how a commander who wasn't ready for war got himself ready for war. He'd been a division commander in Mesopotamia, today modern Iraq, and was chosen ultimately to lead the China-Burma-India theater. And I think, Mac, as you know, and most Americans probably don't know, that was one of the key theaters that brought about the end of the Japanese war effort, because it sapped so much of their strength fighting in their own backyard that it really took away from their capacity to project power.
Yes, sir.
And he'd take command of that theater, not believing or not fully prepared for it. And his advice on how to command a theater in war served me personally when I took command in Afghanistan, another theater of war. So, defeat into victory. And then I think, you know, a couple of the American generals that I really admire, and as you know, Mac, I spent a lot of time studying the Civil War.
Yes, sir.
Ulysses Grant was a great treasure for our nation, and one of the great things about the United States is that it somehow produces men and women of the right character at the right moment in the great crises that we face, who can step forward, shoulder an incredible burden, and bring us success, whether it's military victory or save us from the Great Depression or some other horrible crisis. And, you know, history has not been kind to him, but the decisions that he made as a strategic commander saved the United States of America as the nation that we are today. And it was one of the great examples in our history of a great president and a great commander working together at the grand strategic political military level, not just to win a war, but to free a people, to free the slaves of the United States, to free the slaves of the Confederacy, but of course to free the slaves and to set the state of the United States on the course that it is today. Had Grant and Lincoln not emerged as they did when they did, you and I might not even be having this conversation right now. So I read a lot about the Civil War. I read a lot about the leaders who were fundamental to the outcome of the war. And in particular, I've read a lot and continue to read a lot about U.S. Grant.
All right, final question. I just want you to, for all of you listening, the man who just talked about Grant is a dyed-in-the-wool Virginia man. And somewhere there's relatives spitting in their graves right now, the fact that you mentioned Grant like that, sir. A favorite quote of yours?
It was the quote that I used to give when you and I served together at the infantry officer course. And it's the quote that two warriors have, one warrior to another saying goodbye. You'll remember when we were together, it was during Desert Storm. And it was the moment that we were producing lieutenants for a Marine Corps that we believed was going to end up stuck in the complex obstacles in Kuwait with untold thousands of casualties. It turned out, of course, that it was just a 100-hour war, but at the time we didn't know it was going to be. And so as warriors said farewell to each other, I remember the great quote from Shakespeare out of the play Julius Caesar, and whether we shall meet again, I know not. Therefore our everlasting farewell make. If we should meet again, why, then we shall smile. But if not, then we shall know this parting was well made. And, Mac, you and I are fellow Marines and fellow warriors, and although, we will certainly see each other again. This parting today will have been well made.
Well, first of all, sir, I want to thank you very much for coming on and spending the hour now that you've spent with us. And I can't tell you how excited I was to have you come on the program. And certainly our conversations here bring back great memories of being at Gettysburg, of being at Spotsylvania, at being out at Antietam, and just all the great discussions and all the great learning that took place for a lot of men that went on to become general officers and lead the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And today's just a great reminder of what a special officer that you've always been. And I want to thank you very much for coming on and honoring All Marine Radio here in its first week with your presence. Thank you very much, sir.
Mike, it was really great to be with you. And, you know, I'm so grateful for what you're doing now. I know what your ambition is, your desire is ultimately for this radio to serve all Marines. I think it's a great idea, and I wish you the best in this endeavor, and I look forward to coming back at some point, and we can have another discussion.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Mac. Take care, brother. Out here.